This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna.
Hello again, everyone. A very happy St. Patrick's Day, and welcome to another brand new edition of the show that trainers listen to. It is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton, and it's right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, ready to bring you yet another great story on today's show. I'm really excited to have you with me. I'll tell you more about that in just a minute, but want to remind you that, as always, you are tuned in to Trainer Talk live throughout North America on Sirius 219, XM Channel 201, or you're listening to our free live streaming or the archived podcast of the program. And, of course, you're doing that on our HRRN website at horseracingradio.net. Well, today I welcome the 73-year-old trainer Mike Miceli to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. He was born in Toronto, Canada, and Mike first became interested in racing at the age of 16 when he accompanied his uncle to the track. He has spent more than 5 decades in the sport of thoroughbred racing, so we have plenty of things to talk about. He started as a jockey, very successful career there, and then has transitioned over to the trainer side of things and has had a lot of success on that side too. Please join me in welcoming trainer Mike Miceli to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Mike, appreciate the visit.
Yeah, appreciate you having me on, Mike. Go ahead.
Yeah, excited to hear your story, and I guess we should probably just start in the very beginning. I mentioned that you grew up, or at least you were born in Toronto. How long did you live there? Did you grow up in Toronto, or were you just there for a short time?
Yeah, I was born and raised in Toronto, and right in the city. I was a city boy. Didn't know nothing about the track or horses or anything. The only horses I saw was, the milk wagon horses in the city. But I had an uncle that worked at the track. He brought carrots and greens out to the track kitchen, and also he supplied the horsemen with carrots. And he brought me there one day, and actually my father kind of coaxed him a little. You could see my dad lit the spark, and my uncle put the gasoline on the fire here, you know. And, once I got to the track, it was during the summer vacation from school, I decided I liked it and I loved it and didn't want to go back to school. So we had a little trouble. My mother and father kind of wanted me to finish up high school and stuff. But the lure of the track grabbed me, and that was all she wrote, you know.
Now, your dad lit poured the gasoline on there, or lit the fire, however you just put it, Mike. If your dad was such a fan of you going to the track with your uncle, why was it that maybe he was like, okay, hold on a second here, you need to get some education first?
Yeah, they wanted me to finish high school. I was, I guess, in my second year of high school, and they wanted me to finish. But, you know, my dad was more understanding, and then my mother kind of joined forces, and I was off to the track to Woodbine, and everything got started at Woodbine in Toronto.
How far was your house from Woodbine?
Oh, it was about 20 miles, because I lived in right downtown in the city. And Woodbine was like, it was a journey to get out there, to tell you the truth, in them days, you know. So my uncle picked me up at the house, and then moved me to the track, and, you know, got a room at the barn and learned how to walk horses and kind of started from there.
You know, it's interesting. You started by talking about the fact that the only horses you were familiar with were horses that were pulling the milk wagon, and that's a term that I am familiar with, but there are people out there listening going, what on earth is he talking about? Mike, what was Toronto like in those days?
Well, Toronto, you know, like in the city, it was congested because there was a lot of cars, and like the guy that would deliver milk to the houses used a horse and with a little box in the back of it, loaded with the milk and crates, and they would drop off milk to the people. You know, it was easier for them to get around in the city. And they would park the horse in one of the garages in the city, like in back of a house. They would rent a garage and put the horse there. And that was going back into the early 60s. So, you know, of course, you know, that's been outdated for a long time now. But that's the first glimpse of a horse I had, you know. So then I started going to these horse shows that I'd watch these jumping horses and stuff like that. They had them in the city that they would have horses going over the little hurdles and stuff like that. So I started watching that. And then when my uncle, my dad told my uncle, why don't you bring him out to the track and see if he likes it? And that's basically how we got started, you know.
What do you remember about that first day that you went to the track with your uncle?
Well, the first day I went there, I was brought up in the city, so for an Italian family, and I remember going to the track kitchen, and they had like meatloaf and this and that, and I said, "Geez, but no pasta here, no nothing, you know." My diet was different than when I was a kid, like being raised in an Italian family and stuff like that. So we had to get tuned in a little bit more to the diet at the track. But we adapted very quick, so it didn't hurt me at all.
Were either one of your parents interested in racing before you started working at the track and going with your uncle?
Yeah, my dad was the track. We had a track right in the city called Greenwood, and my dad would go to Greenwood to bet the horses. He would take me along, and in them days, you had to be, I think, 16 or 18 to get into the track, so I kind of had to sit outside for a little bit and kind of position myself in a spot where I could see the races and stuff. So it kind of captured my imagination, and I kind of fell in love with it right from when I was exposed to it.
Isn't that amazing the way things have changed? Now you walk around Saratoga, for example, and you see families out there with children in strollers and kids running around the picnic area. It has changed so much since the time that you first got involved, Mike.
Oh yeah, definitely, and I think it's great because it introduces kids to the track at a much younger age, and kind of grow our fan base a little earlier than what we used to, and we just hope it continues that way so racing can thrive.
So you start going to the track with your uncle. Where did it go from there? How did you initially get your first job on the track?
Well, I got my first job on the track was with an ex-football player. His name was Les Lear, and he used to play football for the Chicago Bears, I believe, and I think even Los Angeles. And then he became a coach, and he coached the Winnipeg Blue Bombers to their first Grey Cup win, which would be similar to the Super Bowl. So he was a rough, tough guy, and I came around with him. I stayed with him for at least 3 years. In them days, you had to have a contract with a trainer so that you could get your apprentice jockey license. And I stayed with him for 3 years, and he taught me well. There was no babying around. He was a tough guy. I always remember one day a horse threw me, and I managed to hold on to the horse, and he kind of leaped forward and kicked me with both feet right in the chest, knocked me back about 10 feet, and I couldn't get my breath. So he picks me up with one hand. He was a big, strong guy. And he says, Mike, you go on back to the barn and get on that next horse, you know. And back to the barn I went, got on the next horse. And that night, I remember my ribs were killing me. So, I was living on the track then, and one of the grooms said, you don't sound too good. He says, well, I'm hurting, my ribs, I can't get my breath good. So he took me to the hospital. I had a cracked rib, came back to the barn, and next morning I was in bed. So Les Lear comes in and he says to me, what's the problem? I says, Mr. Lear, my ribs are bothering me. He says, "Oh, come on, I'll fix you. Us football players, we know how to deal with any discomfort like that." So he taped me up like a football player and threw me back on a horse that next morning, and away I went. You know, you're young and you don't, you know, you put the pain behind you and keep going, you know. So it was a good experience. It put a little grit in my personality and knew that, you know, sometimes things aren't going to be comfortable all the time. And I think it was a good education.
Yeah, you know, Mike, it's interesting. You're talking about the cracked ribs. The only time I've even come close to that, and thankfully they weren't cracked, was just some bruised ribs. And I can remember how painful it was just to get a breath, a deep breath in. I can only imagine trying to gallop a horse and breathe with cracked ribs. Forget about, you know, being 16 years old. It doesn't matter. That had to be so painful.
It was painful, but, you know, I guess the will to, you know, survive and keep going was kind of a driving force, and you know, you just put the pain behind you, and you knew what you wanted to do, and a little discomfort, and you learned to accept it and keep going. So, like I say, it was a good learning experience.
You said you were there for 3 years. Where'd you go after that?
Well, we left Woodbine, and we went to Florida, and we went to Gulfstream Park, and it was the first year I was ever south of Buffalo. So I didn't know what Florida was like, but all I knew is that we were in the horse van, and when I got to the Florida border, we stopped to give the horses water and stuff, and I saw these palm trees. I says, "Holy smokes, where the heck have I been? What kind of trees are these?" You know, so for a young boy, never farther south than Buffalo, it was a learning experience, you know. And we got to Gulfstream, and then that next summer, he never went back to Canada. We went to Monmouth Park, I believe, yeah. And I kind of got my roots at Monmouth and started riding a couple of, you know, like about 2 or 3 years later. And just kind of stayed on the Jersey circuit from there.
Were you thinking all along that you were going to ride races? Was that the ultimate goal, even when you were just galloping and working horses in the morning?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I used to go to the races and, you know, watch the riders from the backstretch and stuff like that, and kind of picture yourself in that spot someday, you know. And after a couple of years of, you know, learning and stuff, you know, I got to start riding, and I think it was 1966, started riding at Monmouth Park, win my first race there. And then we went from Monmouth Park to Atlantic City. And this Les Lear, he was a pretty fortunate guy. He had a couple of good horses. He had a horse called Sadair, who was a two-year-old champion that year, and he was winter book favorite for the Derby. And he wound up breaking down during the winter. He broke a foot or something. And then he wound up with a filly called Native Street, who wound up winning the Kentucky Oaks, and she was a top race filly. And I remember I was at Atlantic City Racetrack, and one of the grooms says to me, "Let's go get an overnight." You know, in them days, it was 24-hour entry rule. So here I am the next day on a filly called Native Street, and she had won the Kentucky Oaks that spring. And here I am, a 10-pound apprentice, and I used to gallop her every day, so I knew her very well. And Les Lear, I remember him getting a phone call from the owner, and it was fellow named Butch Salmon, and Butch says, "Hey, Les, I see you've got Mike on that horse, 10-pound apprentice. You think he's okay?" He says, "Well," he said, "Butch, I think that he handles her very well in the morning. He gallops her, he breezes her. I think it's a good match, and we'll put her in one of these allowance races. We'll get the 10 pounds, and it'll be a good comeback for her." Well, anyhow, that day she just galloped. She ran like the first three quarters and won a week before. And that was my third win. So to get on a good filly like that and your third win, that was pretty fortunate, you know.
Yeah, it's spectacular. Talking with trainer Mike Maselli here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. As you have just heard, or if you are just joining us, Mike began his career as a jockey, had a very successful career in the saddle, and then began training horses after he finished up right around 1989 or so is when he launched his training career. And we'll talk about some of his top memories from his training career coming up shortly. But, Mike, one thing you mentioned was sitting alongside the the rail watching some of the veteran jockeys before you started riding, thinking, okay, that's what I want to do, and I can be that person. Were there certain jockeys that you would look up to as a kid, and maybe even jockeys that you got to ride with that really helped you along the way?
Oh, yeah. You know, when I first started riding, I used to see Bill Hartack. I remember when he came up to Woodbine to ride Northern Dancer in the Queen's Plate. He had just got done winning the Derby and Preakness on that horse, and he rode him in the Queen's Plate. And he galloped in that race, came from way back, circled the field, and win. And later I would kid around with Bill Hartack once I got to riding and stuff. I'd say, hey, Bill, you know, it broke my heart. I was just a young kid, and I was by the rail, and I said hello to you, and you never answered me. And he said, well, you sure I did that? I said, oh, yeah, you did that. I was just kind of kidding around with him, but... Those were riders in those days, like Braulio Baeza was riding there then at Hialeah. And, you know, you'd walk in the jocks room as a young kid, and you'd be with Braulio Baeza, you'd be with Bill Hartack, Shoemaker, Cordero Velasquez, Vasquez. I mean, every one of them were, you know, Hall of Fame riders. So it was... they were like kind of like my idols, and to be participating with them, you know, was a great thrill for a young rider.
I can imagine it had to be just, you know, kind of almost like an out-of-body experience when you walk into that jocks room for the first time and you realize, hey, it's my first day riding races, and there's Shoemaker, and there's Cordero, and there's all the big names that you just mentioned. It has to be somewhat overwhelming, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, it was quite a thrill, and to be able to compete with them and win races against them, it was a good feeling. And don't forget, you know, you couldn't make many mistakes in them days because you're riding with a bunch of Hall of Fame riders, and if you made a mistake, they would eat you up, kind of, you know. So you had to be very, very precise on what you were doing out there.
I can imagine, though, Mike, that's probably something that helped you be so successful because you almost had to be good if you were going to ride with those people, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, when I came around, the riders that were riding with me about the same age as me were like Craig Perrett, Chuck Baltazar, Eddie Maple. We were all about the same time getting started, you know. And they all went on to do successful careers, you know, very talented riders.
One of the highlights of your career was finishing second in the 1974 Kentucky Derby. That was a really magical year for you as a rider, and I'll let you tell the story. But let's start with the Kentucky Derby. You're riding a horse by the name of Hudson County. He went off at odds of 5-1. There were 23 horses in the Kentucky Derby that year. I went back, Mike, and pulled up the chart. It was a race that was won by Cannonade, who was trained by Woody Stevens, ridden by the legendary Angel Cordero Jr. Take me back to that day in riding in the 1974 Kentucky Derby.
Well, that was the largest field in Derby history, 23 horses. I think I came out of post number 17 that day. Hudson County was a pretty talented little horse. He wasn't a big horse. He was about maybe 15 and change hands high, but for a little horse, he had a pretty big stride. He was primarily a sprinter, and we won the Bay Shore with him, going 7/8 at Aqueduct. Then I rode him in the Wood. He was third. Then in the Derby, he was second. It was a big field. I was able to get a good position, laying about a fourth, fifth, you know, the first part. And he got the lead at the head of the lane, and I thought it was on to victory. And then along come Cannonade with Cordero on him, and I guess we got beat about a length and a half that day. But it was quite a good feeling, and the race was marred with a lot of trouble because of such a big field. And from that, I think from that year, they reduced the size of the field because there was just too much traffic in the race, and which was a good thing because 23 was a lot of horses.
What is that feeling like when you turn for home with the lead in the Kentucky Derby?
Oh, great feeling. Thought it was on to victory, you know, so just riding as hard as you can to, you know, just try to stay in front, and, you know, you just hope somebody don't catch you, but that day we got caught, and you know, everything as far as the strategy and the race, everything played out the way the trainer Skippy Shapoff had in mind. And at the time, you know, I really didn't think about it. But now that I'm training horses, you know, he did such a fantastic job making a sprinter. He broke his maiden, I think, at Gulfstream, going 3/8 of a mile in one of those, you know, 3/8 straightaway races. And he run 3/8 and 32 and 4 as a 2-year-old. So, you know, to get a horse like him, who was primarily a sprinter, and get him to run a mile and a quarter, it was quite a good training job on the trainer's part, you know. And like I said, you don't realize it so much at the time, but now that I look back and you know, see what he had to do to prepare a horse like that, I can appreciate what he done, you know.
Yeah, great learning experience, especially for somebody who is now on the other side of things and in the trainer's seat. And I am visiting with trainer Mike Maselli here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Mike, fast forward to the summer of 1974, a couple of huge wins with a horse by the name of Holding Pattern. Tell me a little bit about that.
Holding Pattern is a horse that I wound up on that year also. And I won the World Playground Stakes with him as a 2-year-old. And then we didn't see him till later that next year. And a trainer named J.J. Sarner had him. And he was a guy that raced around the Midwest, mostly Chicago, Arlington, and stuff like that. And he would go to Florida in the winter. Well, anyhow, that winter in Florida, I got to see him, and he says to me, "Mike, you know the little horse you won the playground on? We're going to try to get him ready for some big races." So he was delayed. He couldn't make the Derby and stuff like that. So I had Holding Pattern. I had Hudson County for the Derby. But later that summer, he had him ready, and I wound up riding him at Monmouth Park in the Haskell. It was called the Monmouth Invitational. And he went by nose. He beat a horse called Little Current, who was the 3-year-old champion that year. Horse of, Darby Dan, I think, owned him, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then 3 weeks later, we took him to Saratoga, and going a mile and a, you know, up at Saratoga, mile and eight. And he wound up winning the Travers by a nose also in the slope. And he beat a pretty damn good field. He beat Little Current again, who was the 3-year-old champion. And the 3-year-old champion filly was in the race that year, a filly called Chris Everett. So it was a star-studded field. And you know, he was a tough little horse. He gave you all he had. And you know, he's a pretty good horse. He's kind of always been in my heart, you know.
Yeah, as I was getting ready for the show, I went back and watched the replay of that 1974 Travers. And as somebody who grew up an hour from Saratoga, the Travers has always been near and dear to my heart. And you held off that late charge from Little Current. He was flying on the outside, and you had just enough left to hold him off. Did you know he was coming, Mike?
Oh, yeah, you always knew he was coming. He was a type of horse that he would, like, lag back in the back of the field, kind of last, next to last, and then he'd come charging. So when we beat him in the Haskell, it was kind of a learning experience. The only way I knew I could really beat that horse was to try to steal off a little bit earlier and hope to last, you know, because he had a very good closing punch. And both times we used that strategy, it worked out to our advantage, you know.
That's such a skill that jockeys possess, being able to time it so that you open up at the right time, you make your move at the right time, but you make sure that you don't use all of your horse up and you still got enough at the end to finish. How does a jockey do that, Mike?
Well, it's more or less, you know, a lot of people think it's like a clock in your head. You're just going by feel, what you have under you, how much hold you have of your horse, and you know, you just try to, you know, save as much as you can, because the races are won the last quarter mile, especially in those big races. So, you know, you always got to bear in mind to have a little something to finish with. Otherwise, you're going to come up empty where it counts, you know?
You know, I grew up playing baseball, and I remember I had that one day when it was just kind of a magical day. every time you walked up to the plate, you knew that you were in the zone, and the pitches, when they threw the ball to you, it just looked like a basketball that you were swinging at. And I had a day where I went 4 for 5 with 4 home runs, and the fifth one, the guy caught right up on the warning track up against the fence, so I was very close to having 5. I was a little frustrated I didn't get 5. You had a similar day at Meadowlands when you rode 10 races one day. You won 6 of those. Tell me about that day, Mike.
Well, they had a double card, and I think I was on 5 on each card. And, going into it, I said, I got a shot to win a couple of races. And then I'd win 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, then the 6th one come. But, in them days, I was so driven, and, I lost one winner that I would have had because I breezed the horse, and I don't want to say the trainer I breezed him for, but anyhow, he breezed a little fast. He breezed like 47 and change, and he wanted him to go a little slower. Sometimes you mess up and, wasn't done deliberately. But so he took me off the horse, and I said to my agent, I said, this filly's a nice filly. Got to try to get back on. So I went to try to get back on and couldn't. So after I won the 6th, I'm driving home. I was living at Monmouth then, and so we would drive home at night. And I was thinking to myself, man, I would have had 7 if I would have wound up on that horse. 6 wasn't good enough. I guess I was being greedy. But, that one win bothered me a little bit. But then I pinched myself. I said, it still was a good day,
That's what drives all great athletes, though. You're never satisfied unless you win the championship. There's no second place, right, Mike? I mean, that's what keeps you going and keeps you motivated.
No, it's all about winning. You're judged on performance in this business, whether you're a trainer or a jock, you're judged by performance, and you got to, be able to take the heat and compete and try your best in every horse you ride,
Do you think you're still as competitive as a trainer?
Very much so. I'm kind of a quiet introvert out of my shell as I kind of matured. That burning desire is still there. A lot of people think, because I'm subdued and quiet about things. I always remember watching a race at a horse, and Gary Contessa was standing next to me, and he's just like, saying to me, Mike, you didn't show no enthusiasm. I said, I showed enthusiasm. It was in my heart and in my soul. But I says, until they get across the wire first, I don't like to say anything, It kind of was a close finish that day. So he said, you're cool. I said, you got ice going through your veins, I guess. So I always remember saying that. But that's just
stuff.
The type of person I've always been,
Yeah, he is trainer Mike Maselli, and he is with me here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton. In the second half of the program, we're going to spend plenty of time talking about his training career. He's had a lot of success there, too. We'll talk about it next when we come back. This is Trainer Talk presented by Fasic Tipton, and it's right here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Fasic Tipton is bringing the heat to Miami with the Fasic Tipton Gulfstream Sale of selected two-year-olds in training. The nation's premier two-year-olds in training sale will be held on March 31st after the Florida Derby over Gulfstream Park's dirt racetrack. The sale has a history of producing the sport's very best horses, including last year's Grade 1 Arkansas Derby winner Nadal, as well as top horses Bellafina, Dona Veloce, Yapin, and Share the Ride. You will find no higher concentration of quality in any two-year-old sale in 2021. The Fasic Tipton Gulfstream Sale, March 31st at Gulfstream Park. Where will you be?
Mr. Monomoy is bringing his speed and outstanding pedigree to the state of New York. Mr. Monomoy broke his mane in his second start at 2, running 6.5 furlongs wire to wire, winning by 5.5 lengths. Prepping for the Kentucky Derby, he won the historic Grade 2 Mile and an Eighth Risen Star at Fairgrounds by 2.5 lengths. Mr. Monomoy's half-sister, Monomoy Girl, is a twice Breeders' Cup Distaff winner and a double Eclipse Award champion. Other stallions that are half-brothers to two-time champions include leading sires Kozan and Into Mischief. Mr. Monomoy has the impressive looks to complement his race record and pedigree. Book your mare today to the next stallion that has all the momentum to be a perennial leading sire in the state of New York.
Make Woodbine the place to train and race your thoroughbred in 2021. Take advantage of competitive purse structures with huge bonuses for Ontario breds and a Woodbine backstretch equipped with a 1 mile dirt training track, a 7 furlong turf training track, a 2 furlong sand ring, and a 1/2 mile European jogging path. Racing surfaces include a 1 mile all-weather Tapeta main track, a 7 furlong inner turf course, and the 1.5 mile EP Taylor turf course. Opening day is April 17th. Follow us at Woodbine TV on social media and reach out to our team at woodbine.com.
This is Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
On the outside, Holding Pattern from between horses, Chris Everett coming on again. It's Holding Pattern in front by one. Chris Everett is second, and here comes Little Curran on the outside. Holding Pattern with Little Curran coming on. Here's the finish. Holding Pattern holds on and wins it by a head, but ducking Mike Maselli aboard.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, with you on this Wednesday program. And that was Dave Johnson with the call of the 1974 Travers. Mike Maselli aboard the winner, Holding Pattern, probably the biggest win of his career. And there were many good ones, but when you win the Midsummer Derby, it kind of takes you to another level. And you heard Mike talk about it in the first half of the program. If you missed any portion of this show, all you have to do is head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk shows at your leisure, horseracingradio.net, Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts as well. Mike, I want to get into your training career, but after hearing that call, you know, I told you I went back and watched the replay to get ready for the program. And now that you get a chance to hear Dave Johnson's voice in that call again, what were some of the things going through your mind as we were coming back from the commercial break?
Well, it brought back fond memory. You just made me stroll down memory lane with that one, which is always enjoyable.
Yeah, it was a sloppy track that day, as it tends to be at Saratoga from time to time, but it didn't bother Holding Pattern at all. A very game victory, holding off the 3-year-old champion of that year, Little Current. And it was one of the moments that stood out to Mike in his riding career. He wrapped up his riding career in, Mike, what was it, 1988 or so? Was that about right?
About 89, I believe it was.
89,
the latter
okay.
Latter part of 88 going into 89.
Was that a tough decision?
A couple months off and, after that, and kind of spent a little time with John Forbes in New Jersey. I rode first gold for him 1 year prior to Julie Krohn winding, getting that stable. And I went out to the barn and spent a little time around him and see what it's all about. And I'll tell you, Mike, you as a jock, you think you know it all as far as, you know, why did the trainer do this and why did the trainer do that? But, you know, when you change careers and you wind up in the barn, you find out how much you don't know about a racehorse. And so that was a new learning experience starting all over again. So, you know, it's kind of a something I always tell jocks that are retiring. I said, look, if you want to become a trainer, spend a little time with somebody, and because you'll find out how much you don't really know.
That's a great way to put it, Mike. And it sounds to me, from listening to you talk in the first half of the program, you kind of reference the fact that when you watch a race, you're very reserved. You know, you're not boisterous as the horses are coming down the stretch. That's just the way you are. That's what your personality is. And you've always been very humble. And to hear you say that, you know, look, I thought I knew it all as a jockey, but, you know, you start hanging out with a guy like John Forbes and you realize how much you don't know. John Forbes trained more than 2,100 winners in his career. He had multiple graded stakes winners. What were some of the things that, as you started to embark upon this new profession, you had to learn, or maybe even surprised you that you had to learn?
I'll tell you, every, you know, basically you get thrown into the barn, and I started training a few horses for a very close and personal friend of mine, Tony Shimetta. He was the owner of Old Glory Stable, and we went from, when I was riding for him, I was riding First Call for him, we went from like one horse to 50 in a matter of 2 years, and we did quite well together, and we had a great association. He was truly a great friend, and learned a lot from him about life, and you know, he gave me my first chance. He gave me a couple of horses to get started with, and I think I had two or three horses when I came here to Aqueduct and got started here. And I figured it'd be better because my wife and kids were, my kids were young, and I didn't want to have to be traveling back and forth to Jersey all the time because it felt like I never got to see them. So we moved here to New York, and it took a little while. We went finally win a race or so, and then I kind of got stranded here because my dear friend passed away, and as a young man, he got cancer when he was 49, 50, he was gone, so I was kind of marooned here and kind of had to start from nothing, and didn't really know anybody because I spent most of my riding career in New Jersey and Florida. 1 year I went to Oaklawn Park, so basically I was on this circuit with two or three horses, and my brother-in-law was a bloodstock agent, Joe Brocklebank, and we bought a horse or two together, and we would pinhook them. In other words, we would buy them, break them, get them broke, sell them as two-year-olds, or what we didn't sell, we would bring here to New York and race and try to sell them out of the barn after they either win or were second. It was always better if they were second because then the new people would have the maiden victory going for them. So we got lucky the first year or two doing that, and as far as, you know, knowing what to do at racehorses, I pretty well got thrown into it. You know, I was glad I spent a little time with John Forbes, because he basically knew what they had to get in their diet and the training methods and stuff like that. That kind of came a little natural, being that I was riding, so you pretty well knew, you know, when your horse was fit and stuff like that. But, you know, it was a whole learning experience, and thank God, you know, we survived here, you know, so it's good.
Was that somewhat of a scary time for you, Mike, knowing that you left your career as a jockey, started as a trainer, your dear friend passes away, you're basically starting with scratch and learning on the fly, you have the wife and the family. Was that a bit of a scary time personally for you?
Yeah, yes, it was. I wouldn't describe it as scary. I was just concerned because I wanted to provide for my family. I had three kids, and they're going to school, and here I move them up to New York, and, you know, we're kind of struggling along. So, you know, when you look back at it, Mike, I think it was, it taught my kids, the value of a dollar, and at the same time, they became appreciative of whatever they had in life. And so, you know, the script was okay. I have no beefs, no qualms. We fought along and picked up a few owners along the way and we just kind of hold our own every year. And, you know, I basically, my stable used to be like maybe 10 would be max. Now then it grew to 15. This winter I was up to 22. Then all of a sudden I found that I had horses that really didn't belong or needed time, so it got kind of cut down in half right away in the month of January. But we still had a pretty good start this year. You know, we win a stake in January here with the filly called Mrs. Orb. She was a pretty consistent filly, and we had a few other wins that a couple of guys from Ocala sent me a few horses, a guy named John Shaw, a girl named Danzel, who has the classic bloodstock down in Florida, she sent me a couple. We went a few races for them. So the Ocala connection kind of helped me this year. In the past, it didn't help me that much, you know, but it seemed like when I needed it the most, it came through this year for us, you know.
Yeah, you've gotten off to a really fast start. 9 wins from just 39 starters. That's a 23% win rate. There's nothing wrong with that, Mike. And you mentioned the fact that people are sending you horses, and that's always a good thing.
The maidens kind of slow you down. When you got the claiming horses, they kind of keep the momentum going. Maidens, you're basically running them, and if you're competing here in New York, so you got to pretty well have a decent maiden that can. So sometimes the maidens will slow you down a bit, but Claiming Horses took their role this year, and that one filly that won the stake in January kind of got the ball rolling this year.
You saddled your very first winner as a trainer on my 18th birthday, believe it or not, February 3rd, 1989, at Aqueduct with a horse by the name of Distinct Intent. What do you remember about that day and that race?
Distinct Intent was a horse from Baltimore, I think, in his late two-year-old year, and bought him in New Jersey from a fella, and we brought him here to New York. The first time or two that we ran him, he didn't run any good, and we kind of put our some money into him and got him right, and then Nick Santagata actually win our first race with that horse, and I think we went two or three, and then he was claimed from us, you know.
Yeah, as always. Do you remember the thrill that was the thrill of winning your first race as a trainer equally as exciting as winning your first race as a jockey?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, because, with training horses, you put a lot of time into it. When you're a jock, you ride a horse, maybe you're on five that day, you go in the jock's room, maybe one doesn't run good, and you go over the horses you've ridden that day with your age, and I would say, that horse, maybe we better look for a different one because I don't think he's good enough to win, So, with the training horses, you're kind of stuck with them. They're in your barn, and you got to figure a way that you can turn a loser into a winner. So sometimes it works, sometimes it don't, Mike.
So many trainers have made that transition that you made, going from riding races to then training after they finished up their riding career. And they'll often talk about the fact that once you give a leg up to the jockey, you lose control of everything that you've worked on for the past several weeks or several months with a horse. How big of an adjustment was that for you, Mike, when you first started training?
Well, you pretty well know what the horses are, what knowledge you've gained from the horses in the morning, and then you try to reiterate that to the jock that's going to ride him that day for you. Some jocks listen, some jocks don't, and you have to have a little confidence in the rider that you're using, because you might say, I want to let you'll be laying third in this race, and maybe the speed horse stumbles, gets away bad, and you're left on the lead. And now let's say you get beat. First thing most trainers would say, well, what the heck, I told you to lay third. But you would, as a jock, you would say to the trainer, look, so-and-so didn't show the speed that I thought he would. We assume command, and we tried to slow it up as much as we can, but we just got outrun. So you have to have confidence in who you're riding and hope that they're going to do the job for you. Sometimes it works, sometimes it don't, Mike.
When you were riding, were you pretty good about following instructions, or would you just kind of do it your own way?
Well, I would always pay attention. That trainer's been with the horse longer than I have, and he pretty well knows the horse. And if we made a mistake, if it was a guy that I was friendly with, I would say to him, I might have messed up. Maybe we should have just went to the lead, and I took the horse back and kind of held him down, and then when I asked him to run, he just kind of spit the bit out. So that's kind of, if it's a mistake, I always found it better to discuss it the next day when I was riding with the trainer. Maybe we can learn from it and move on and help the horse and help to win the race.
Visiting with trainer Mike Maselli on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike, you talked about some of the struggles that you went through early on as you were getting your career started, your training career started. What was the moment that really catapulted you into a level where you said, okay, we're okay now, we're going to be able to do this, and I know I can train horses?
Well, the more you win, the more confidence you get in your decision-making. But I would say probably the last 4 or 5 years, I found, all the experience that I've gained in the first 25 years training horses is paying off, because you've learned how to navigate the road. You know where the bumps are. You know what can happen if you go on with the horse. And now I'm able to navigate things a lot better than I did in my earlier days when I first started training, because you've hit some of them bumps in the road. You know where they are, where they're at, and you try not to make that same mistake again. So I think it's a business, especially training horses. You can't beat experience, whether you're a trainer, whether you're a jock, whether golfer, whatever, you know, that experience is always good that you can draw back on, you know.
What were some of the biggest lessons that, or are some of the biggest lessons you've learned over the past 25 years that are helping you now?
Well, I've learned a lot of lessons in the years, especially in the last 5-6 years. You know, you got to communicate good with owners. They put their money up. They expect results. And you, like I said before, you're judged by performance. So you need to be a good communicator, which I probably was guilty of not being the first maybe 10 years. You know, because I had my own few horses, and, you know, we always seem to hack out a decent living. But nowadays, with there's so much information at owners' fingertips on the computer and everything, you have to stay on top of things and keep your owner informed, because if you don't do it, somebody else will. So I find the communication with owners is very, very important for the success of the stable, you know.
When I asked you about watching other riders when you were just getting in or thinking about riding races, and you mentioned names like Shoemaker and Cordero and some of the most legendary names that we've ever seen on the riding side, how about from a training perspective, Mike? Have there been trainers that you have watched, at least in terms of their approach to running their business and training horses, and maybe even gone to them to pick their brain a little bit?
Oh, yeah, well, you know, through the years, like when I was riding, whenever Alan Jerkins would send something to Jersey, he always gave me a shot to ride a few winners for him when I was riding. And then when I started training here, he was kind of a guy that you were afraid to really talk to. He kind of had an aura to him. But once you got to know him, he was such a great guy. He was a great human being. He was very compassionate, and he was very, if you listened, he would share his knowledge with you. If you saw that he wasn't in the best of moods, especially if the horse got beat that he was running, you'd probably stay away. But no, I learned a lot from just being around him a little bit. Like, I'd be out on the pony on the track, he'd be on his pony, and he would say to me, "Oh, so and so is moving better this morning, Mike." And I would say, "Geez, how the hell did you know that horse?" You know, he knew he was very observant about horses. And his son Jimmy Jerkins is about the same way. He's a top trainer and just like his dad. So, you know, I would say, you know, you learn from watching other people how they train and stuff like that. Frank Martin with the claiming horses was kind of a wizard, you know, and he turned many claimer into stake horses, you know. So, you know, there was always something that you could learn from just about any of the top guys around here, you know.
Mike, as you were telling that story about Alan Jerkins, I was thinking about how similar it is to my Alan Jerkins story. I was always somewhat intimidated by Alan Jerkins, and I wanted to have him on this program, Trainer Talk, for the longest time. And I remember one day at Gulfstream Park, I finally went up to him after training was finished. I went to his barn, and he couldn't have been nicer. It was such a pleasant visit, and he agreed to come on the program with me, and that was right before he passed away. I never had the opportunity to visit with him and to hear his story on this program, and it's one of my biggest regrets that I waited so long to go talk to him, because he was simply fantastic.
Yeah, that was him. He was a great guy and probably one of the greatest trainers we've seen in the sport. And you know, not to mention there was, you know, quite a few others, but you know, he was kind of a unique guy, you know.
Mike, if you were to describe your philosophy and your approach to training horses, how would you do it?
My philosophy, you know, you got to keep the horses happy. You got to keep the meeting well, and you got to know what each horse wants, because each horse is an individual. And I would say basically, you know, you want to keep them fit without, you know, overcooking them. And at the same time, you want to keep them happy and eating well. So if you can accomplish that, I think you'll get the best out of your horses, you know.
I always enjoy asking trainers to tell me about some of the horses that they're always going to remember for whatever reason it might be. Doesn't even have to be a big-name horse. So if I were to walk into the Mike Maselli barn or walk into your house and I see pictures, maybe wind pictures or whatever it might be, what are some of the things that I'm going to see, and what are some of the horses that are always going to stand out to you, Mike?
One of the horses I had, it's got to be about 10, 15 years ago. I had a horse that we bought out of, actually a fellow from South America sent him to me on consignment to sell. And when we got him here, you have to know how the transition from, let's say, that country to this country, and you try to keep things similar because they go out in kind of sets of big sets and everything like that. Well, anyhow, he was a big horse. His name was Tangarillo. And we run him a couple of times, and then all of a sudden he started coming around, and I run him an allowance race at the Meadowlands, took him over there because I figured it'd be an easier spot in the stud. And then we run him back here. I figured he needed a longer race, so we run him in the Dallin Fox. I think it was a mile and a half or a mile and 5/8, and he wound up winning that. And that horse, after that race, we got an offer from Saudi Arabia to sell him, and we sold him at the right time. So he was a horse that when he was here, we couldn't really get much money for him. And every time I would call the trainer to have him in South America, he'd say, oh, no, that you're not getting enough money for him. I says, well, if we can win a stake with him, I think we'll get more money. So he was a horse that kind of taught me about a lot of stamina, because the guy that had him in South America was training him hard. You know, you graze him twice a week and stuff like that. And the old horses used to be able to take that years ago. But he was a very sound horse. He stayed very sound, and I had to basically train him a little harder, and which we did, and, you know, he paid off.
Are horses
so
different now, Mike?
He was a horse that taught me something.
Yeah, you talk about horses in the past being able to take that type of training and racing regimen. Are horses different now?
I think what we've seen is, I don't know whether it's, we've watered down our breeding by just going after speed more. And, the horses, I can always remember when I was even a kid getting on horses and galloping them, and when I first started riding, horses would win twice a month like nothing. You know, that was kind of standard procedure, you know. And, nowadays, you know, they're lucky if they get over there 10, 12 times a year. But if you look at that horse, like, say, there that I mentioned to you, I think he ran like 12 times as a 2-year-old, you know. Wound up winning, Pimlico Futurity, won the Arlington Washington. I mean, he got over to the races all the time, you know. So they seem to have, were able to take more pounding, more racing, and what exactly the formula is as far as what we did wrong, I really don't know. I think it has a lot to do with gearing for speed, but somehow the breed got a little not as sound as what they were, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's so many philosophies on that topic, and I've talked to so many trainers about it over the years, Mike. I've always been curious that one of the philosophies I've had was that there is so much money involved in the sport now, and there are so many big races, and even you look at some of these maiden races now that are being run for, $100,000 in certain parts of the country. There is so much money involved that trainers and owners are just reluctant to put their horses in a position where they have to race so much or they have to train so much. Do you think that's part of it too, or is it simply the fact that horses aren't as strong and sound as they used to be?
Well, I think some breeds can that I see can take a little more racing and you know, survive it, and with the training and the racing. And then others, you know, they just have you got to kind of baby them along. They can't take the racing quite as much, and you got to. The biggest thing I think in this business is to know when to put your foot on the gas and when to tap the brakes. And if you see that coming and you tap the brakes soon enough, sometimes you can avoid a catastrophe or a horse coming up sore on you. But at the same time, you can't be afraid to train them. You have to send them out there to train, to get fit, and to race. So, you know, it all goes back to, you know, the wisdom that you've gained over the years, that you know, you can forecast that. Some of the young trainers know that you know, they handle mega stables, and they, you know, they do quite well. I take my hat off to them, but it wouldn't be for me, but for them it works, you know. So they more or less can push them a little harder, because they always have another one coming in to take their place, you know. And they like to try to find out what they have quickly rather than wait, because I guess, like anything else, time means money in this business, you know.
It certainly is. Believe it or not, Mike, we are coming into the final 16th of a mile on today's show. This show has flown by. It's been so great to hear your story. Inside of 3 minutes left until we have to wrap things up, I always like to end the show by talking to trainers about some of the things they enjoy doing outside of racing. So are there any other hobbies or sports or things that you enjoy doing when you're not at the racetrack?
Mike, I'm kind of a boring type guy, because I only do two things, my family and horse racing. And I don't golf. I used to golf a little bit when I was riding, but then I tore my rotator cuff so twice, and that kind of had to pack that in. But no, basically, horses take up all my time and my family. You know, I'm dedicated to the two things, and I don't have time for anything else.
You know, I also, like you, Mike, grew up in an Italian household. And you mentioned that when you first started going to the track as a kid with your uncle, you were surprised there was no pasta in the jocks room and in the track kitchens. Do you do much cooking at all?
Well, Lisa does most of the cooking. She's a good cook. And I always kid her whenever she makes a meal, and my son will be at the table, and my two daughters and my grandkids. And I always kid her, and I'll say to her, my son, I'll say, Mike, and he says, your dad taught your mother how to cook, which is far from the truth.
Well, fantastic. Mike Maselli has been my special guest here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton. Mike, again, a delight to hear your story. Thank you so much for taking the time. All the best moving forward, and I look forward to meeting you in person next time I make it up to New York.
Okay, Mike, thank you kindly for the interview. Appreciate it.
All right, wonderful stuff from Mike Maselli. If you missed any portion of the show, head back to our website, horseracingradio.net. You can check out the podcast of this show and all of our Trainer Talk programs at your leisure. Horseracingradio.net, Horse Racing Radio Network on Apple Podcasts. For my special guest, Mike Maselli, for my producer, Lee Delapina, in our Lexington studios, I'm Mike Penna. Thanks for listening to this week's edition of Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton.